What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Let me tell you about this guy I know, Adam. Mean kid. Bad seed. Hurt people.
I like him already.
You know what happened to this guy, Jack? Made mistakes. And then he had us.
Now you want to get nuts? Come on, let's get nuts.
You ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight, Josh?
How about we just settle for a sacred cow review of Tim Burton's Batman, which celebrates its 25th anniversary this summer.
Leave it to you, Josh, to pick Batman over Weekend at Bernie's.
Later in the show, we'll share our top five movies of 1989. That and more.
You got my Endrith music queued up for the top five, Josh?
You bet, Wild Thing. Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Film Spotting listeners, including Austin in Chicago and new $5 a month subscribers David in Wilmore, Kentucky, Daniela in Bartlett, Illinois, Alexander in Seattle, Washington, and John I in Kansas City, Missouri.
We'd also like to thank platinum-level donor Luis Reynoso from Abuja, Nigeria, who sent us this note. I've been negligent in making donations to your show, so I just sent you a Buck a Show donation for every show you have done in commemoration of your 500th show milestone. Roger Ebert's recent passing reminded me how much film has been part of my DNA from a young age. In my humble opinion, your show honors his legacy, at least in some small part. My donation expresses my gratitude for the fine work you guys do every week. Keep it up.
Gratitude indeed. Thank you very much. We're very grateful for listeners like Luis and all of our donors this week. To learn how you can support the show, visit filmspotting.net and click on donate. You can also help the show by rating or reviewing us on iTunes. And to close out, Josh, I can't resist playing this nice voicemail we got this week from Larry in Miami.
Usually I call the vent. Last time was when I think it was Josh took umbrage with Alan's love of Predator. This time calling with unabashed praise, my friends. You turned me on to three of my most loved movies of the last 6 months. Short Term 12, 20 Feet from Stardom, and I finally sat down and put in Never Let Me Go. And, I mean, three in a row. Home run, gentlemen. Thank you so much again. Keep up the great work. Love the show. Turning people on to just great movies. Just had to call and say, thank you.
You're listening to this nostalgia-filled episode of Film Spotting. This week on the show, Josh and I really carpe the diem. We find the Holy Grail, ask out Diane Court, and fake orgasms at the Carnegie Deli, all on the hottest day of the year in Bed-Stuy.
That sounds like an excellent adventure.
Yes, our top five films of 1989 is later in the show.
And if you caught all six references to 1989 movies, congratulations. You're as old as we are.
You've won nothing.
But first, after mulling over a few options for our next Sacred Cow review, we decided on 1989's Batman from director Tim Burton. Why? Because this show needs an enema.
Dampen the city's plans for the 200th anniversary festival.
The festival opens. The police are going to stop these gangsters.
Mr. Dent, what do you think of the theory that the mysterious Batman is a mob enforcer killing these
people? I don't have any comment, no.
Batman. Can somebody tell me what kind of a world we live in where a man dressed up as a bat gets all of my press? This town needs an enema.
Gosh, orgasms and enemas. We can only go up from here, right, Josh?
I hope so.
These Sacred Cow reviews are opportunities for us to revisit and re-examine beloved movies that we haven't seen in a while, often since they were first released. When considering candidates, the key question I usually ask myself is, how likely is it that my response will be significantly different than when I originally saw it? I like the potential for surprise. Tim Burton's Batman, which this summer is celebrating 25 years of destroying its box office competition to the tune of $251 million, was your suggestion, Josh. So enlighten us. What was it about Michael Keaton's cowl that seemed so interesting and inviting to you?
What you just described, I haven't seen it. Probably, oh man, it's been at least 10, maybe 15 years.
Okay.
And the first time I saw it, I was a fanboy. I don't know if you can believe this, Adam, but I was once an actual fanboy. I wasn't always this sophisticated.
Uh-huh.
And that was the time, 1989. I had the Batman t-shirt. I was probably maybe 14 when it came out. And when I saw this, oddest situation, on vacation with my grandparents and my cousin, just the four of us, whole nother story why we were in New Mexico during the summer of 89, but we were.
Bonus and content.
There you go. I begged them, pleaded, we've got to see Batman opening night. And so we went, Albuquerque, saw Batman, some dingy multiplex, and I was in heaven. You know, just thought everything that's the definition of a fanboy to me is that you anticipate something, and when you see it, it doesn't matter what you see, you love it.
Hmm.
That was me.
Okay.
So I wanted to go back and see, did any of this hold up to my present self?
Well, you've basically done all the work for me. I should just let you go from there and answer your own question. But in doing some searching today to get a few facts straight about the production, I came across an article titled 15 Reasons Tim Burton's Batman is Better Than Chris Nolan's The Dark Knight. Now, we wouldn't normally even give lip service to clickbait like this. Yes, of course, it's a slideshow to boot. But not only is the Burton-Nolan comparison unavoidable, I like to think Burton just might appreciate the joke of this present-day phenomenon being applied to his earlier work. So rapid fire here. I'm just going to list these off, and I want you, Josh, to make a note of the ones that ring true. Not going to give you any explanation, just rattle them off. Better suit. Better action. Again, this is in Burton's work. Better cast. Better Batcave, better Batman introductory scene, no boring Bruce Wayne scenes, better theme music, better Joker, and by better, this author means more fun, better Batmobile, better Batwing, better lead, Keaton over Bale, better final fight, better Gotham City, better humor, which is to say, some humor, and the number one reason this writer prefers Burton's vision to Nolan's, more escapism. And that number one actually offers a fruitful place to start, I think. The author says, a comic book opens up worlds which remove you from the miseries of day-to-day life. Nolan is so preoccupied with the notion of forcing outlandish characters like Batman, Joker, and Bane into the world that we actually went to the cinema to escape from. His films lose everything that made Gotham so popular in the first place. And that's the crux of his preferences for Burton, the lack of insistence on making it all seem, quote-unquote, real. Certainly an aspect of Burton's film that struck me on my recent viewing was just how much he embraces Batman's comic book style imagery. And as you'd expect, there's plenty of darkness in Burton's Dark Knight as well, but absurdity abounds in his heightened universe, along with plentiful pastels and goofy gadgets. Do you too prefer Burton's vision to Nolan's? And please share your answer in the form of a list.
I would say about a third of those reasons in that piece are correct.
Okay.
Which means then that, no, it's not better than Nolan's The Dark Knight, certainly, which might be the best superhero movie ever made. I can understand, you get a sense of what sort of superhero movie that writer prefers. And if that's your standard, of course, makes absolute sense that Burton's Batman would be the superior film in your mind. What I really loved about Nolan's take was exactly the things that bothered mm-hmm. this guy, though, is bringing these outlandish characters and scenarios and making them feel real, pulsing on the screen, on our streets, in a way that just made them infinitely more exciting than something like Burton's film, which exists within an imaginary world, frame one to frame end. That said, Batman's a really good film. It's a really strong film, probably for different reasons than I thought when I was a fanboy. I'm obviously looking for different things now. And I think what worked then for me does still work, largely great performances. I mean, really good performances across the board with just these killer moments we've already referenced, lines and how Nicholson and Keaton play them. Those still hold up. But I found things looking back at it that totally went over my head. The vertigo illusions and the ending, I had no idea that was in there when I watched this as a 14-year-old or whatever. And that added to my appreciation. And what I most of all saw this as, and here's a point of connection, I think, between the two franchises. There aren't many, but here's one. And that's the Joker and the use of the Joker as this figure of absolute chaos, the end game of battling with a broken psyche. And I think that you have that same character facing that sort of dilemma in two different ways. In Ledger's performance, it's just bleak. And in Nicholson's, it's comic. But I think they're doing the same thing. And it's such a wonder to see how two different actors can take the same iconic character and give absolutely great performances that are so different from each other. Mm-hmm. If I had to choose, I do find Ledger's just that much more disturbing, which I think gets at the truth of the character a little bit more. But man, is Nicholson good. This is the Joker's movie.
Yeah.
This Batman is about the Joker. I think if we counted screen time, Nicholson might have more than Keaton.
I'd say there's no doubt.
And he deserves it. I mean, again, it's this transformation from a guy who's disturbed, who's scarred in the ways that Bruce Wayne is scarred from his encounter with Wayne when he gets dropped into this vat. And how he responds is the crux of the film. He responds by just pursuing that mania all the way to the end, to that final vertigo scene.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this being done with a light touch. And Nicholson could have, wow, the risks he takes here, this could have been like a career laugher performance. And not all of them pay off. We've got the Dancing to Prince, which I don't think anyone should be forced to do.
He sells it, though.
I don't know if those scenes work.
He didn't say they work.
He sells it in his effort. I mean, he gives it. If they're going to work, it's because of Nicholson's effort.
He believes it. I think he believes it.
I don't know that anyone else does. But that being said, it's that sort of gusto that makes every other scene work. And it's really a performance of he's spoofing himself, but at the same time serving the character. I mean,
right.
He starts out big. The Nicholson that people started to make cracks about at that point in his career. He starts out big in the beginning as Jack Napier, and then when he turns into Joker, he goes gargantuan.
Don't bother. Your life won't be worth spit! I've been dead once already. It's very liberating. You should think of it as therapy. Maybe we can cut a deal. Jack is dead, my friend. You can call me Joker. And as you can see, I'm a lot happier.
Yeah, I think I'm probably with you overall in that I too really like this movie. If I was having to pick, I'd probably go with the Nolan vision. And it's not just The Dark Knight in that article. They're really looking at the entire trilogy there. And then that becomes even more complicated. But the fallacy of that argument in favor of Burton, of course, is that it presupposes that escapism is inherently better
than
whatever we're getting from Nolan, which is certainly more serious in tone, more philosophical, perhaps. But it also suggests that what we get in Nolan's films isn't escapism, or there isn't escapism there. And I would say there certainly is. But you talk about things the 14-year-old you wouldn't have picked out or wouldn't have responded to, and I want to get to Vertigo in a moment. This was actually an instance for me, Josh, a fairly rare one where I wish I had had more time to actually do some research before getting into this discussion, maybe even hear more from the director and their take on the film, because I'd be really curious to get Burton's perspective on a couple of choices he makes, and one of them is the fact that the actor who plays the mayor in this movie, and this is a relatively small aspect of the film. Mm-hmm. He barely has any lines, but Lee Wallace is the actor, and he's just called the mayor. He's the mayor of Gotham City, which, of course, is always a stand-in for New York City.
Right.
He's a dead ringer for New York City's mayor in 1989.
I think when I was a kid, I thought it was Koch.
Yeah.
I thought he was doing a guest performance.
Right, and I think 14-year-old me would have gotten that. I think I probably would have still recognized Ed Koch. He was ubiquitous enough in the media, but the Gotham City portrayed here in this movie is not too far off from New York City of the time. It didn't really start to become this cleaner family and tourist-friendly place until around the mid-90s. New York City's reputation of the time this movie is being made and is coming out is more of the Bernard Goetz 5 years mm-hmm. earlier, the vigilantism, the crime running rampant. And the film, of course, does open with this scene of a mother and father and a kid not unlike a young Bruce Wayne.
Great switcheroo, which I had forgotten, too.
I had, too. I thought it was them.
Yep.
And then I realized, oh, no, this is the present. But it's very similar. It's clearly meant to echo that. And they're walking along these New York City streets, and they are really seedy locations filled with prostitutes. And they go down this dark alley, and they get assaulted and get mugged. Everything about the New York City we see in this movie from the opening scene is really dangerous. And so it is interesting to me that even in this at times very silly comic book world Burton gives us, he grounds the movie in a reality that would have been familiar to any New York City resident, but also I think anybody in the United States who certainly sees enough of New York City in the media. Metropolis is one of the things that gets alluded to here as well. I think very blatantly, some of the German expressionism, the opening shot we see of Gotham City, it feels like something right out of Metropolis to me, with the buildings, the skyscrapers really kind of crunched together.
For sure.
And there's this sense of this being a little bit of a dystopian nightmare. And so I do wonder, is it almost by casting an Ed Koch lookalike and making us think about New York City in that way, is it almost wish fulfillment that this hero emerges to rid Gotham of its bad guys, as if that could be that simple?
It could possibly be, but the movie doesn't seem... that all makes sense, and it's true. It gives you that feeling, but it's still in this separate bubble, this Burton bubble, that I don't know if that resonates as well. And also, I think the reason if it does, it's secondary, is because for me, it really is a psychological portrait film. It's a psychological dark comedy is what I took away from it most of all. And I suppose that shouldn't be surprising, and it shouldn't be surprising that Joker comes to the fore here when we think about the films that Burton had made up to that point. I mean,
only
Beetlejuice,
two, right?
Yeah, Beetlejuice and Pee-wee's Big Adventure. I mean, look at the characters he was drawn to there, these outsiders in one sense, not necessarily the good guy in Beetlejuice, you could say, and disturbed personalities. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the primary focus of this film. And it does set it then again within this backdrop that the reason, you know, I think a filmmaker would do that is because when you're dealing with a property which was at that point, 30, 40 years old, maybe you're going to need to bring some contemporary relevance to
maybe,
it.
Yeah.
And so a good way to do that is to make those allusions to New York City a little more vibrant and a little more clear through the production design and the casting. Mm-hmm.
Well, you mentioned the psychological aspects of this film. Let's get to that, because that is the other main thing that I latched onto this time that, as I said, 14-year-old me wouldn't have gotten. And maybe it speaks to my ignorance overall about Burton and his body of work. I'm far less an aficionado than you are, but I do see him. I've always seen him as unique. I don't think of him as a director who's heavily influenced by others or who pays a lot of time to homages. He always seems completely distinct in his vision. And the last director I'd ever put in a sentence with Burton is Alfred Hitchcock.
Uh-huh.
And yet, Batman is so steeped in Hitchcock that it's almost a quasi-remake of Vertigo. It's not just the end scene. Of course, the bell tower sequence at the end immediately recalls the end of Vertigo. The shots, often, the circumstances, certainly. But before that, when Bruce tells Vicky he's going out of town, she trails him. She takes photos of him from her car. And we spy him, she spies him, putting flowers down in the alley at the exact spot where his parents were murdered. A clear allusion to Scotty following Madeline in Vertigo. She goes to a florist. She buys flowers. She goes to the grave of Carlotta Valdez. You also have the Joker altering his girlfriend's appearance, which altering Judy's appearance. And Batman, at the beginning of the film, drops the Joker into that vat of toxic waste, just like Scotty drops the criminal at the beginning. There's probably more Vertigo in Batman, but the other Hitchcock movie I thought about a lot was Psycho. The way Wayne Manor is shot, it's so dark and so uninviting. It's like the Bates house in Psycho to me. And of course, Bruce calls Joker a psychopath at one point in the movie. But you've got Norman Bates, suffers from a split personality, the same way both Bruce and the Joker do. One of them keeps it a secret while the other flaunts it, but it certainly links Bruce hiding in that house, occasionally spying on his guests just like Norman does. It does link him to Norman, and you could actually even make the case that Batman and Joker are the two sides of Norman Bates, one channeling his pain for good and being helpful, the other one just, as you put it, just embracing the madness, embracing chaos. And I do love the line that Bruce Wayne has when he's at Vicky's apartment and
the
Joker comes in, and Bruce leans in and he says, "I know who you are." And
that's the line of the movie,
I think. The first reading of that, the simple reading is, I know your real identity.
Your identity.
But that's not really something he's keeping much of a secret. It doesn't really matter if anyone knows he's Jack Napier, this guy used to be under Grissom, the crime boss. What he's really saying is, I know what you are. And he knows what he is because they are two halves of the same whole.
Bruce? Bruce Wayne, n'est-ce pas?
Most of the time.
Yeah, you make a really good case, especially for Vertigo. And you're right. I don't think of Burton as an homage director either. So who knows how much of this he intended, or maybe it was in the screenplay.
And what would the impetus be?
I mean, we should note here, because we've already credited the movie with that great turnaround at the beginning, the screenplay writers, Sam Hamm and Warren Scarron. Maybe it was more their intuition to go and make this an homage to Hitchcock in a number of ways. But I think this identity question is something that you see popping up in Burton's work. And your comparison of the two sides of Norman Bates, that is dead on, because one reason Burton is able to get away with giving this movie over to Nicholson. I mean, think about the hype and the buildup here about this being Batman movie. And then he goes and it's 60% Joker. Well, he's able to do that because it's a movie about these mirror identities. So when you're watching the Joker, you're watching Batman, and vice versa. And we don't get caught up in the fact that Batman has been off screen for a while because his dilemma, his drama, his narrative has been on screen right there in the Joker. And that's why I think that scene between them in Vicky's apartment is key. Now, this also is where we should probably point out, if you feel this way, that Keaton is as essential and as good as Nicholson.
Yeah.
I mean, I do remember the talk after he was cast, despite him being in Beetlejuice and having this association with Burton. What in the world are they doing casting Michael Keaton? But again, this isn't an action movie. You wouldn't cast Michael Keaton in an action movie. And boy, that piece you mentioned is way off in claiming the action is better than Batman. We can spend a little time on that. But it's a dark psychological comedy is what this is. And that is what Michael Keaton is perfect for, because he's always a little bit unhinged or a little bit off, or you can see that unpredictability. You don't quite know where he's going to go. And he plays that in every scene. Another little off moment that I liked reviewing it this time was good, because it was all the smaller scenes that I really treasured, whereas when I was a kid, it was like those big moments. I was like, that's what I've been waiting for. A small scene that I loved here early on, when Kim Basinger and Robert Wool are touring Wayne's mansion at a benefit. They go into his weapons room.
It's a great scene.
And they're walking around making fun of all his collection, and he's trailing them unknown, like 5 feet behind. And as Wool makes a joke, Keaton just kind of like laughs, like, that's kind of funny.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's showing
himself
already. He's enjoying himself. He's very confident as Bruce Wayne. So he pulls off the playboy part. But also, key to this overarching theme is that he's able to regard himself outside of himself, because it's the first clue this guy's got split identities here. And so it works on all those levels. And man, the confrontations with Nicholson are just so electric. When you get two actors, it reminded me of the beginning of American Hustle, actually. When that opened up and you see Christian Bale, Bruce Wayne, and all of a sudden you see Bradley Cooper come in, not putting him at the level of either of them, at the level of Nicholson, really. But you see these two actors who we know are electric, right? And you know in that opening moment, they're going to go at each other.
Right.
You can't wait to see what happens. That's what every scene of Batman is when you get Keaton and Nicholson together.
I'm going to kill you. You idiot! You made me, remember? You dropped me into that vat of chemicals. That wasn't easy to get over. And don't think that I didn't try. I know you did.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing Batman. The 1989 Batman is one of our sacred cow reviews here on the show, and we are saying it is a sacred cow, not a false idol in this case. We're
correct.
Both fans of Burton's version. But you're so right about Keaton, because I've always loved Keaton. I remember, even at that age, the movies I had seen before, loved him in those comedies, that charisma and just his charm. I didn't see how he was going to be this more brooding Batman figure. But honestly, it was less than that, because I wasn't as familiar with the Batman persona and mystique. It was more that I saw Batman as an action film. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know how all maybe 5'10" of Michael Keaton and his slight frame was going to somehow be imposing at all. And he pulls that off, because you're right, there's not a whole lot of action with him in the film. In fact, it's one of my criticisms of the film, even though you make a really good case for why it is this way. And that is, it's so the Joker's movie that Batman is actually a little bit too passive for me. There are too many shots of him just sitting in his lair watching things on TV. Right. He's like watching the news and stuff, and he's just not that active. We only see him actually go out, if I'm recalling right, go out and fight crime, that one introductory scene. Otherwise, things come up with the Joker, but he's not out there being aggressive like we see Christian Bale's Batman in the Dark Knight trilogy.
And when he does, he's almost in slow motion.
Yeah.
It's like they have him drifting in on these wires. I think as imagery it works. As action, it's almost
Maybe a little silly. Though I'll say this, I will actually take any of the action scenes in Burton's Batman over the action scenes, especially at the end of Batman Begins, which I just think the cutting is terrible. And I took no pleasure. There was no escapist fun in any of those action scenes at the end of that first Nolan Batman film. But Keaton just, he exudes this darkness and this conflicted nature that is actually expressed verbally in the other Batman movies. Christian Bale talks about his angst a lot. The demons he's wrestling with. He wrestles with them, not only physically, but mentally and also verbally. You don't really get that so much with Keaton, but he just seems damaged. And the way he does, except for one scene where he gets a little big like Jack, it's in that same scene where he tries to act a little bit crazy. He really does reduce that charm. He's such a naturally charming guy, and he just takes that down about 100 notches. And it's very effective here because the movie doesn't go very far from a screenwriting standpoint, and Burton doesn't seem that interested in it. Again, he's so focused on the Joker that the movie doesn't really reveal the Bruce Wayne character in a totally satisfactory way. And again, that gets back to the fact that we just kind of see him sitting around a lot, but it doesn't get into that inner angst so much. We just have to believe it. We have to maybe be enough familiar with the Batman mythos, which I think probably a lot of people were, but also you just have to see it in Michael Keaton and understand that a guy living in that house who sits at that table across from Kim Basinger and isn't even sure how to really feel and exist in his own space, that there's just something wrong with him.
I think it's partly that it's just starting to tell his narrative. Again, the primary narrative is the Joker's. And so we see that really from beginning to end in Batman. I'd have no idea if they envisioned this as a trilogy or what the thinking was. But seeing it independently, it very much feels like we're just starting to get an understanding of who Batman is. Enough for this film. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was lacking, but at the very end, I felt that there were some big questions left. And one of them speaks to the phrase, the description you used, conflicted nature. Because again, he's positioned, the Joker has been scarred. His response is chaos. Bruce Wayne has been scarred. His response is to create this alter ego to keep this other personality in a nice compartment. He compartmentalizes it. And here's the interesting thing. He does it in a way that it is supposedly going to serve justice. But there's very much a question. Obviously, he does here because he's paired against the Joker. I mean, there's really no other option when you're forced up against that. But there's still that open question throughout this film. Is this, and this has been something throughout the Batman legend, is this figure something that we want or need? Or is this a vigilante that's dangerous? That's expressed a few times by the law in this film. But also, it's expressed in the scene early on where he drops the Joker into the vat. You don't know. It wasn't clear to me.
It's not clear.
If he's like,
it's a great ambiguous moment.
Yeah, and that plays into the psychology as well. So plenty of Wayne psychology for me in this film.
Well, I actually wonder, I'm going to throw out there, even though I admit it may seem a little bit too neat, but there were a couple moments and a couple lines in particular that struck me as maybe being indicative of why Burton might have been so drawn to the Joker character versus the Batman character. And I wonder if it has to do with his maybe kinship with him in terms of recognizing him as kind of this freak. And Burton has kind of been seen as this Hollywood outsider, as a little bit of a freak character.
That's how he's described himself as his childhood experience.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
And there is that line at one point where I think the Joker is talking to Vicki Vale and he says, "I now do what other people only dream. I make art until someone dies. See, I'm the world's first fully functioning homicidal artist." And you could almost apply that to a lot of the grimness of Burton's work. That's almost a philosophy of what we see on screen in a lot of his films, not all of his films.
They're grim. I don't know if any of them are homicidal.
But seeing him, well, there's a lot of death in a fair number of Burton films.
Yes.
He kills off a lot of characters. And I'm just wondering if that sense of him being an artist, actually seeing him as any kind of an artist, is what drew him to that character and really is the through line with him. Because one of the things I struggled with, and it doesn't sound like you did, because I think the answer would simply be the Joker, much like the Joker that we get from Heath Ledger, is simply an agent of chaos. Now, in the Nolan version, he's an agent of chaos who has a point to make, right? Mm-hmm. He wants to make some kind of fundamental point about human nature.
With society.
Playing games, and he's also then playing that game that gets caught up in Batman's inner conflict of why am I even trying to save these people? What should I be doing? What shouldn't I be doing? So that all works. Here, it did bother me a little bit, I have to say, how sort of unfocused the Joker's motivation seemed to be. Like at one point, he wants to turn everyone into Joker-like people,
right.
But then he really just kills them.
Right.
And then later, he's going to give them money, but just to get them down there so he can kill all of them. And he's a complete egomaniac who wants power since the opening scene. And I'm left wondering at the end of the film, if you're going to kill all of Gotham City, who's going to worship you?
Well, nobody said he was a good artist. I mean, I think
right.
you consider him a flaky artist. You know, he's really into something for a little while and then time to move on.
That's
his,
it.
His
right?
first project, Jerry Hall, didn't work out so well.
That's true.
So let's try something different.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that plays a little bit. It could very well be a fault of the screenplay not following through on those threads for sure. But in watching it, it just felt to me part of Nicholson's impulsive,
right.
ridiculous performance.
Yeah.
That you never knew where he was going to go or why he was doing things. The only pursuit of anything that he has, and I think this ties back to Vertigo, is to settle on who he's going to be. And there's it was interesting when I mentioned the Vertigo thing in my written review on this, and then I linked to it on Letterboxd. Somebody on Letterboxd asked me, can you follow that down a little bit? Because I don't quite see the comparison, particularly in the Jack Joker character and the Madeline Judy character mm-hmm. that I was making. And it made me think about it a little more, and I realized, you know, as the film progresses, he uses less and less of the flesh-colored makeup
right.
on himself. At first, he'll put that on in certain situations so that he still has the scar grin,
mm-hmm.
but he's got his normal skin tones. And eventually, as the movie goes on, he gives up on that to the climax where he's embraced his full Jokerness. So he's decided, this is who I'm going to be. Similar thing happens at the end of Vertigo, and in a way, it costs both characters
yeah.
to be truthful about their identity.
Well, he's decided who he's going to be. And again, if we stick to the split idea, them being split personalities almost of each other, he goes so far to an extreme that way. And Keaton's Batman goes even further to the other extreme, where he's going to settle down a little bit and embrace life with a girlfriend. He's going to mm-hmm. welcome someone mm-hmm. into
yeah.
his world. He's going to be a little less fractured and a little less dark, I think. So that does make sense. The other thing that I was thinking about as the movie went on, and I freely admit that I don't think the movie necessitates this kind of overanalyzing, but I was thinking about it as I was watching the movie this time. It's the motivation the Joker has for why he wants to kill Batman. What is the reason? Right? In all the Nolan films, it's very clear what their objective is, the bad guy's objective is,
right.
and how Batman fits into that. And you look at this one and you're like, okay, well,
there's a little jealousy there.
It's jealousy,
I guess.
Because he says at one point, they call him a winged freak. Wait till they get a load of
right,
me. One of
right.
the great Jack lines. It's that ego thing again, where it's about being the number one freak.
Stealing my press.
Stealing his press. Okay, so that is part of it. And I suppose he's got all these impulsive, crazy ideas, and Batman keeps thwarting them. So I can understand why he'd want to kill him for that. But then the other thing is at the end of the film, he says to him, "You idiot, you made me, remember? You mm-hmm. dropped me into that vat of chemicals. That wasn't easy to get over, and don't think that I didn't try." So, of course, he's out for a little bit of revenge. But at other points in the film, remember he says to one of the bad guys when he's asked, "What's with that stupid grin? Life's been good to me."
Uh-huh.
And when he's talking to Grissom, to Jack Palance, he says, "Jack is dead, my friend. You can call me Joker. And as you can see, I'm a lot happier." Mm-hmm. He genuinely seems happier. I would think watching Nicholson's Joker that he actually thanks Batman, is grateful to Batman for unlocking
yes.
that madness.
No. You're right. Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's part of it. I think it's he's a kindred spirit in a way, too. One of the little Nicholson touches I like is that he wants to kill Batman, but when he does show up to thwart his plans, who gets the biggest smile? Like,
right.
he's so happy
he's impressed.
To see him. He's like, "Oh, I'm so glad
yeah.
you're here."
Where does
here?
He get such great toys
yeah.
or whatever? He just
and
loves that he shows up.
There's just this glee over it. I mean, the Joker is happier to see Batman than the people who Batman has come to save in this movie.
That's true.
And I think that makes sense with this twin identity thing.
Well, I probably shouldn't keep analyzing it and point out that it does kill me that we have to get the scene where Batman is coming to mow him down in his Batwing and has him locked on target and shoots machine guns and missiles at him and somehow misses, and the Joker pulls out a long gun and shoots him out of the sky.
And that piece,
it's so bad.
That piece you mentioned claimed this Batwing was better?
Yeah.
Then, well, I would say not.
I wish Burton
sounds like
had,
a faulty Batwing to
had
me.
Had rethought that along with some of the print scenes. Though, you know what? In doing some of that reading, it seems that, in fairness to Burton, some of that print stuff was really WB's insistence. They're trying to move soundtracks. So, again, didn't do a whole lot of research,
I
buy that.
I mean, yeah, I just kind of assumed that was part of the franchise package that does not add anything.
A VHS copy of Burton's Batman is currently gathering dust in the attic of your parents' house. It's right next to your Nintendo. It's also available via streaming from Amazon and at your local neighborhood video store, probably. If you revisit Batman and agree or disagree with anything we had to say, email feedback@filmspotting.net.
I'm going to duck out and blow dry my hair. It could use a little lift for our Massacre Theater scene up next. Then we'll start our list of the best movies of 1989. The Film Spotting Top 5 is after the break. Stay with us.
Signor Leonato be her father, she would not have his head on her shoulders for all Messina, as like him as she is.
I wonder that you would still be talking, Signor Benedict. Nobody marks you.
What, my dear lady, disdain, are you yet living?
Is it possible disdain should die while she hath such meat food to feed it as Signor Benedict? Courtesy itself must convert to disdain if you come in her presence.
Then is courtesy a turncoat? But it is certain I am loved of all ladies, only you excepted.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. That was not Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson, but Alexis Denisoff and Amy Acker as Beatrice and Benedict in Joss Whedon's 2013 adaptation of Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing. Before we get to Massacre Theater and our favorite films of 1989, we wanted to share a couple of notes, including plugging my appearance, Josh, at Illinois Shakespeare. Some of our listeners here in the Chicago area, or maybe some of the smaller communities out there in southern Illinois, may be familiar with Illinois Shakespeare, of course, down there in Bloomington Normal. And I'm going to be doing a talkback after the production of Much Ado About Nothing on Sunday afternoon, July 27th. So me and the artistic director of Illinois Shakespeare, Kevin Rich, we're going to be doing this. We're going to talk about their production, but also talk a little bit about Joss Whedon's adaptation of it. So if you're into Shakespeare, if that sounds intriguing to you, we will post all the information you need about getting tickets and dates and times in our show notes at filmspotting.net.
That sounds like something you should probably get a good night's sleep beforehand for, be well prepared for. You're going to be able to do that?
No, I'm not at all, Josh, because as it turns out, of course, the previous evening, Saturday night, July 26th, we are going to be commemorating our 500th episode with a live show.
Oh, that's right. That's nothing, Saturday night.
Nothing big, just a 9:30 show. Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure we're going to want to grab a few
early
drinks
start
with our listeners afterwards. And yeah, so getting down to Bloomington Normal the next day.
You won't have had any sleep, actually.
No, probably not.
Great.
I may just have to stay up all night and make it down there. But we do hope you're going to come out and help us celebrate our 500th episode. Many special guests lined up for that show. And you don't really need special guests. Come on. Us?
Let's
just
mention the
movies?
Special guests. I
should
think
we
should mention the special guests.
I love your humility, Josh. Yes, we are hoping, we are still planning at this point, that Rian Johnson, he of Star Wars fame.
You can say that now.
Yeah, you can. And Brick fame, if you want to go there. The Brothers Bloom, also Looper, very popular film and very good film from a few years back. He is scheduled to attend our 500th show. Also, Michael Phillips from the Tribune, our friend Dana Stevens from Slate. I'm hoping we're going to book her travel pretty soon, and she's going to make it down. So again, we think it's going to be a really good time, and we hope you'll make it out. All the information about that production as well available at our website, filmspotting.net.
And a new venue, right? If you've been to a couple of our live shows, this will be a little bit of a different experience being in the main theater at the Music Box.
Yeah, we've done Lincoln Hall before. We've done the main stage a few times, both amazing venues, but the Music Box, a bigger venue and historic. It's really just a landmark here in Chicago, especially if you're a movie lover. So there you go. Even if you don't like us much, just come spend the evening at the Music Box.
It is a beautiful room.
It really is. Our bonus content this week, this is some of that extra audio we like to feature sometimes in our apps. If you have the Film Spotting app for iPhone, Android, or Windows 8 phone, we're going to talk about our top five immigrant movies. I miss this top five. I think Michael Phillips from the Tribune was in for that. You discussed the James Gray movie, The Immigrant, and shared your list of movies about immigrants. And to set that up, to tease it a little bit, Josh, we've got this email from Ben Johnson. He's in Missouri City, Texas.
I enjoyed your top five immigrant movies, but I think it could have used a dose of humor. In particular, I'm surprised that Coming to America didn't get any love, even as an honorable mention. Eddie Murphy's portrayal of multiple characters really works in this one, unlike his more recent efforts. The movie also manages to be an interesting commentary on 1980s America from a foreigner's perspective. Keep up the good work, and remember, when you think of garbage, think of Akeem.
A great line, and you know, I know this is very easy for me to say now and to pander to Ben and our listeners, but if I had been there for that top five...
Yeah, this would have been your number...
Five or four?
Really?
Certainly an honorable mention.
Okay.
Coming to America is a very funny movie featuring some very good performances.
Did we do a Massacre Theater of Coming to America?
Maybe.
Or did I just dream that?
I think we did.
Did I just wish dream that?
If we haven't, we need to.
We do.
It's certainly been discussed, and we will transition now to some bad performances as we get to Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. A few weeks ago on episode 495, we reviewed the Oregon set Night Moves, shared our top five Pacific Northwest movies, and massacred this scene.
Believe me, I want to. I just want to be married to you first.
You really make me feel like I'm some sort of like villain trying to steal your virtue or something.
It's not my virtue I'm concerned about.
Are you kidding?
It's just one rule I want to leave unbroken. It might be too late for my soul, but I will protect yours. I know it's not a modern notion.
It's not modern. It's ancient.
That was Kristen Stewart as Bella and Robert Pattinson as the gastrointestinally challenged Edward in Catherine Hardwicke's Twilight, written by Melissa Rosenberg, based on the novel by Stephanie Meyer.
So Josh kept his shirt on because he wasn't the werewolf, but his eyes were gleaming, or whatever they do in those films.
Well, their skin glistens
their skin
like diamonds.
Oh, man.
I mean, Pattinson's eyes always gleam.
Yes. So. I'm outing myself here. I am not a Twihard, as one of our listeners is here. I was, though, playing the Kristen Stewart role, decidedly playing with my hair. The
yes,
whole time.
You were.
I had to get into character. Brad DeMoss from Sylmar, California writes, "The most obvious connections to the show are that Twilight Eclipse features Dakota Fanning, who stars in Night Moves, and Robert Pattinson, who stars in The Rover, which was mentioned in the preview for the next episode. In addition, Twilight has a rather unfortunate connection to one of Adam's favorites, Twin Peaks. Both projects take place in the Pacific Northwest and became giant pop culture icons, so much so that a tourism industry developed around the locations where they were shot. Ironically, some of the Twin Peaks locations that seem so connected to the Pacific Northwest were actually shot in the hills surrounding L.A. I've even had breakfast at a hidden restaurant that was one of the locations where the Bookhouse Boys met. Damn fine coffee."
Very nice. You know, before I sound like a Twilight expert, I should note, Brad correctly identifies that scene was from Eclipse. Did you have any idea which Twilight movie we were doing? No, me either.
Well,
I saw the guesses starting to come in. I was like, oh, that was from Eclipse.
Wasn't it from the first one? Is Eclipse the first one?
Isn't it just Twilight?
I don't know.
And I have seen, I think
How
I've
dare
seen
we?
Three of these. So
well,
I have some expertise.
Let's get,
let's get
Daniela on the phone.
An expert. Daniela Griffiths from Bartlett, Illinois. Yep, she identifies herself as a Twihard. Not just a Twihard. I'm probably the only sad Twi super hard that listens to your show. I knew after about two words exactly the movie you were reenacting. The Twilight Saga Eclipse. Okay, see? There we go. I think it should be noted to those non-Twihards listening that Edward, Robert Pattinson, is not supposed to be dying in that scene. He's long deceased and sounds much perkier in the film version, where he's proposing to his beloved Bella Swan. Maybe that's your version of a romantic voice. Poor wife. Thanks for bringing together my two passions, Twilight and film spotting. By the way, Vision Quest
yes.
rocks.
My new favorite listener.
Daniela, slow down. You're exposing yourself as a Twihard and a Vision Quest fan in the same email.
Go for it. Go for it. Daniela, you got to come to our 500th episode. Drinks are on me. And a quick look at the Google, Josh, tells yes. me that Twilight was 2008. Twilight Saga New Moon, 2009.
So when's
Twilight
when's
Saga
Eclipse?
Eclipse, 2010. So it was actually wow. the third one, which, wait a second, you mean to tell me that couple doesn't have sex until the third movie?
There were 18 of them, so they had to pace it out.
Come on. All right. Well, if you want to hear that episode and hear our renditions of Robert Pattinson and Kristen Stewart, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or listen to the show at filmspotting.net. Josh, reach into the Film Spotting hat. I think there are some Twihards out there because it was fairly brimming. Reach in, pick out this week's winner.
One of the many who were embarrassed to admit that they recognized that scene from Twilight was Rachel Lee from Salem, Massachusetts.
I love it. Vampires, werewolves, witches.
There we go.
It works out perfectly. Congratulations, Rachel. Email feedback at filmspotting.net to claim your very own Film Spotting t-shirt.
Dracula requires presence. It's all in the eyes and the voice and the head.
That's right. That's right. You seem a little agitated. You want to go outside and get some air?
I'm ready now. Roll the camera.
We get now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and we do change the name here slightly, mm-hmm. though, of course, there's a little bit of a hint if you really know your performances by this particular actor. And Josh, I was going to say, you know what? I'm going to let you have whatever role you prefer. You're by far the better actor slash hammier actor. So,
whoa.
So, sorry. You know, it's the truth. I got to bring it sometimes. I was going to let you pick whatever you wanted, but the fact
but this
is...
this is something you've been dying to do since 13.
Since I was about 14. Yeah, and you haven't seen this movie, so you don't deserve
no,
it.
It's true. I could not do it hammy justice.
Well, I probably can't either, but you're going to start it off. I'm going to give you the action. Are you ready?
Yes.
And action.
Well, Mr. Castle, you can add 9 staples to your dossier of 31 broken bones, 2 bullet wounds, 9 puncture wounds, and 4 stainless steel screws. That's an estimate, of course. I'll give you a local.
No, thank you.
Do you enjoy pain?
Pain don't hurt.
Most of my patients would disagree with you. Okay. Do you always carry your medical records around with you?
Saves time.
Your file says you've got a degree from NYU. What in?
Philosophy.
Any particular discipline?
No, not really. Man's search for faith, that sort of shit.
Come up with any answers?
Not too many. And scene.
I don't know. Pain may not hurt, but I have a feeling watching that movie would be very painful.
How dare you? If you know what scene we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback at filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, July 14th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on the show in 2 weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
From the heart of Bed-Stuy, you're listening to We Love Radio.
Doing the yin and the yang, the hip and the hop, the stupid fresh thing, the flippity flop. Oh, I have today's forecast for you. Hot!
What better way to bring you back to the summer of 1989 than the voice of Samuel L. Jackson as Mr. Senior Love Daddy and Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing? This is our Do the Right Thing Memorial Top 5 list of films from 1989. So we're excluding it because I think we both agreed that it would very obviously be our number one choice.
Clearly my number one. Yeah
mine yep. as well. So rather
and it's
than,
in the Pantheon.
Yeah, it's in the Pantheon, but Pantheon doesn't matter when it comes to these
year-by-year
year
year,
lists.
That's true. Okay.
No, so...
Man, these rules.
Pantheon, I know. The penalty box, because these are authoritative lists.
Well,
I mean,
I know.
This is important
Heaven
stuff
forbid
here.
We break one of these rules ever.
That's right. So, the Pantheon is fair game, but Do the Right Thing is not fair game. And I did want to acknowledge that we got many emails from listeners suggesting that the time would be ripe for a 25th yeah. anniversary look at Do the Right Thing, including this email we got. Josh, if you want to read it, I'm going to butcher the name. I sought their guidance in pronouncing it correctly. I'm going to go with Harry Sundarison.
Dear Adam and Josh, I would love for you to do a show on Do the Right Thing. I saw this movie for the first time last week, and when I finally stopped singing Fight the Power by Public Enemy, I was able to appreciate all the great film suggestions Film Spotting has given me, from Brick to Grave of the Fireflies to Never Let Me Go and now Do the Right Thing. It's been 25 years since the film came out. That's an anniversary, right? Anyway, I think now is a particularly relevant time to review it, in the sense that I think that film will always be particularly relevant. Okay, that's a cheat, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on Do the Right Thing, how they've changed over the years and what the film means to you. Thanks always for your insights and film recommendations over the years.
So thank you very much for that, Harry, and a great idea. We had already settled on Batman at the time those emails came in, but Do the Right Thing is one we've kicked around for a while. I'm not expecting to be surprised by Do the Right Thing. I don't remember the last time I saw it, but I know I'm going to love it again.
I think that's probably our hesitation with it, which may not be the best reason. For me also, I know I won't be surprised. I have seen it recently. I spent a little time talking about it on episode 410 when we did, along with Michael Phillips, our Sight and Sound inspired list
of the
top 10 movies of all time. It was on my list. So
it made your top 10. It wasn't
my actual top 10.
Okay.
So spent a little time on it there. I mean, it's enraged. It's cathartic. It's empathetic. All these things. And you've got Lee working at the height of his considerable filmmaking powers. So, yeah, it deserves a sacred cow for sure. Mm-hmm. But maybe doesn't quite fit all those requirements we've put on the category.
We did go instead with the 25th anniversary of Batman earlier in the show, of course, but some of those Pantheon movies I think we will get to eventually. These year-by-year lists, though, is something Film Spotting started, I think, maybe 5 years ago, maybe even 6 years ago, just looking at movies that came out before the show started in 2005 and saying, okay, let's go back and explore the films from those years, 2004 on down. We're actually at 1992, but sacred cow picks like Batman sometimes inspire us to veer off course a little bit. We've done 1981 in conjunction with Raiders of the Lost Ark, for example, and we probably will dance around like that from time to time, but we also expect to get back to the best films of 1992 here pretty soon on the show. So all of that said, Josh, top five films, 1989, what do you got?
All right, number five is The Killer from Hong Kong director John Woo, who gained global notoriety with his bullet ballets of the late 1980s and into the early 1990s. These were gangster movies such as A Better Tomorrow 1 and 2, Bullet in the Head, Hard Boiled, and this one, The Killer. Hollywood audiences probably know Woo from the likes of Face Off and Mission Impossible 2. Now, like many of his films from that 80s period, The Killer stars Chow Yun-fat, this time as a mob hitman who accidentally wounds a karaoke singer while he's on a job. He damages her eyesight and then subsequently falls in love with her. He tries to help her set up some surgery, but that gets him caught between the mob and the police. I mentioned ballet because that's what the gunfights remind me of, and many of these involve those standoffs that would be liberally borrowed by Quentin Tarantino. But you could also describe The Killer as an opera. That plot alone, you could get a sense of the grand story at play here, and there is agonized emoting, often over-yearning karaoke music. The characters make these grand physical gestures even, and many of them are documented in slow motion. And you do have that tragic central relationship, this idea of you have a blind woman who's unknowingly in love with the man who caused her blindness. Overwrought is probably an accurate word to describe the movie. 20 seconds in, we've got The Candles and the Doves, you know, that Woo became known for. But those touches, everything in here, it's overwrought, but it's in such a committed way that I just found it irresistible. And I also think that this melodramatic technique, it does help. It helps the movie accomplish one of its primary directives, which is to establish Chow's killer as this iconic, almost mythical character. Listen to how an inspector at one point describes him to a police sketch artist. He says, in his 30s with some crow's feet, he has a manly air about him. He's a bit different from your average murderer. He's very calm, quite intelligent. His eyes are very alert, full of compassion, full of passion. And the progression there I love, because it goes from this clinical police report to a love letter. And in some ways, that's what The Killer is. It's this love letter to the screen charisma of Chow Yun-fat. So
yeah,
that's my number five.
It's a great pick. It's a movie I'm a big fan of. It's an honorable mention for me. Le Samurai, of course, is a film that came up recently in our top five movie tattoos that we would get. And it's been discussed here on the show a few times. There's some overtones, certainly, in The Killer. And John Woo has been on record as being a huge fan of that film, wanting to remake it. So a
lot of echoes there. Le Samurai,
good,
right.
Good pick. I went back and looked at our website archive, and it turns out, Josh, that back in 2006, so sometime in that first year of the show, the first full year of the show, Sam and I did our best movies of the 1980s. And I looked at this after I'd already formed this list, and it turns out that three of these picks were on that list.
From 80, three of your movies,
yes,
were from 89.
Three movies from 1989.
It was a good year.
That's how
I
good.
I mean, it really was strong when we looked back at it.
Yeah. Now, a little bit of a disclaimer, like we do from time to time with these lists, in order to engender more diverse idiosyncratic choices, we had set aside five obvious 80s movies, five obvious classics as untouchable, like Raging Bull, for example. Mm. So obviously, if we were truly doing the top five of the 80s, the list might be a little bit different. But nevertheless, I was looking at that entire decade, and I still focused in on three of these films. So maybe that speaks to me just being too short-sighted and focused on these particular films. But I do think it speaks to how good of a year, as you said, 1989 is. And my number five, I really wrestled with this, and you're going to get me wrestling with it here on air, because when it comes down to it, I think it's the perfect number five choice in terms of an introduction to a list like this, where we're going back and we're considering what are the movies I would have loved in 1989 versus the movies I love now looking back at 1989. And is there a conflict there, or are you somehow still in sync? And this one comes down to that head versus the heart battle, my current self versus my former self. Is nostalgia going to win out? My head tells me that the number five film of 1989 is Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Okay.
My heart tells me that the number five film of 1989 is Cameron Crowe's Say Anything.
Oh, wow.
And Josh, the heart is going to win out.
As well, it should.
I'm going with Say Anything. And this is all I have to say, because I truly just waited until the very last minute to make a choice here. If it comes down to living in a world where I can pop in my DVD and spend some time with Graham and Anne from Sex, Lies, and Videotape, their names I had to look up, or Lloyd Dobler and Diane Court, I'm going with Lloyd and Diane. Simple as that.
You know what?
What?
You're a great date. I've never really gone out with someone as basic as you.
Basic?
So what's your job this summer?
Job? Being a great date.
No, I'm serious.
So am I. I want to see you again. I want to see you as much as I can before you leave. You said it.
I only have something like 16 weeks.
16 weeks is a long time.
You call me tomorrow.
Today's tomorrow.
Then call me later.
Okay.
I love it. I loved it when I saw it then. I love it every time I pick it up on TV since. It's a movie that I believe has continued to age well, and that character, the Lloyd Dobler character, is just an iconic cinematic character for me.
I think that's a valid choice. If I had been able to revisit it, it might have cracked my top five. I have seen Sex, Lies, and Videotape recently, and it certainly holds up. Honorable mention as well. Both are for me. But yeah, I would have gone that way as well. All right. So number four then?
Indeed.
Okay. For me, it is Batman. We spent a lot of time on it in our Sacred Cow review. So I'll just mention a couple things that we didn't get to. You did touch on the German Expressionism in the production design. Anton Furst was the production designer here, doing brilliant work. And I think that is a real strength of this film. Metropolis is an obvious influence, the Fritz Lang film, especially in that scene in the art museum. It's also the scene of the unfortunate dancing by Nicholson. But if you look at the design of that museum, it's almost like the underground factory in Metropolis with giant doors and these industrialized touches. The statues in this movie are just amazing. They call to mind the Atlas statue at Rockefeller Center, but that's sort of like a triumphant one. And here you have these hooded figures who are stooped and the globes on their backs. It's like, it's just the globes are crushing the figures into the ground. So it emphasizes the grimness of this city that you talked about. It's like Art Deco gone to seed. Beautiful, beautiful production design. And I want to tie in also to the imagery that Burton does overall. It's not a very well-directed action film in the action scenes. There are a lot of close-ups that are trying to mask, I think, some staging that isn't quite working.
Well, let me just throw in there. Did you notice how when they were staging the big finale scene with all the people of Gotham out for this thing, maybe it was intentional to suggest that not many people came out for the money, but it looks like they had about 40 extras. That's it.
They ran out of extras money.
It's like in a giant the smallest Batman mob production. Of people trying to get $20 million you've ever seen.
Yeah, I think those big action set pieces are a little lacking. But what Burton's really good at, and maybe you could argue is more important for a comic book property, is the iconic imagery that he gets.
Yeah.
And there's the Batman stuff, which I think is good, but there's also his favorite character in this movie, the Joker. That shot of the Joker's hand coming up out of the toxic waste, where it's just chalky white, the fingernails are bright green, and it's this deeply disturbing, sinister day glow. The bright colors here are drawn from maybe some of the early comics, but also used in a sinister way. So yeah. I love that imagery. What else about the film can I say? One thing we didn't get to that I think is really funny, just a throwaway moment. You mentioned Jack Palance as Carl Grissom, the crime boss. The first scene between him and Nicholson, before Nicholson is turned into the Joker, I love how I talked about how Nicholson is doing big Nicholson already. Palance is doing Nicholson. It's like he's in Nicholson's face giving a Nicholson impersonation. And not only is that fun, but then as the Joker towards the end of the film, he calls back that exact speech that Grissom gives him and just ratchets it up a degree. So that's where that sort of self-parody that Nicholson is playing with just works so wonderfully for the movie.
Carl, we get somebody else to do this. And the fumes in that place. Jack. It's an important job. I need someone I can trust. You are my number one guy. Now, don't forget. You're lucky, Dak.
You know, thinking back on it, I didn't notice any Palance imitation of Nicholson. I mean, Palance is another big actor with a really distinct voice. But absolutely, the scene where Nicholson is giving a mission to his henchman,
Bob,
just like Grissom did to him, he does say it in this very definitive Jack Palance voice. And I actually rewound it just to prove that my ears were correct in hearing that he was going back and hearkening back to Jack Palance there. So you're right, good stuff. And I'm with you on the imagery. That's something we didn't get into completely, but right from the very beginning of the film, the black and blue background that seems so clearly painted, the night sky, it looks like something out of a comic book, the yellow lettering against it, these images, you talked about the hand coming up out of the waste. That's a great image, not because it's something that seems like it was taken right out of a comic book, but it's great for the same reason someone would draw it in a comic book. That image alone is evocative. There's something powerful. It is great storytelling. And there's another great one too, of course, very famous, that the moment Burton takes and the little break Bruce Wayne takes as Batman, when during that big finale action set piece, he goes up into the night sky and has to just hang the Batwing, making the Batman emblem against the moon, right? Just taking that moment to give us that iconic shot, that's the kind of stuff that makes Burton's Batman really work.
Although maybe that's also what threw the Batwing's aim off.
True.
When it came down too quickly from
the goofing around. If he just stuck to it, he would have hit him. Yeah, would have gone much smoother. Well, my number four is a film I loved as well in 1989, but having revisited it recently, I can say that it's not just nostalgia. I liked it even more recently than I did back in 1989, and it's Steven Spielberg's Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. I actually wrote on Twitter after seeing this film, because we were preparing for our top five Spielberg scenes, I'm not saying that Last Crusade is better than Raiders of the Lost Ark. I'm not sure that I would put it up there that high because I do love Raiders, but Harrison Ford's performance in The Last Crusade is better, more well-rounded, deeper
it's
overall.
It's very different.
It's very different. He gets a lot more to do, and there's more heavy lifting, if you will, along with the same great action stuff and everything you'd expect from Harrison Ford. That's all there, but I do think it's a deeper performance. The jokes are better overall in The Last Crusade. I think the humor is actually more effective. And the ending is way better. The ending with the knight guarding the grail and you chose
wisely. You love the Holy Grail scene, huh?
Everything about that is so much better than the kind of kooky ending we get in Raiders of the Lost Ark, though I do love that final shot involving the Ark from Raiders. Those aspects are all better. And then, of course, there is the key thing that really holds that whole film together is that father and son storyline and Sean Connery's performance and Harrison Ford's performance, their chemistry together as father and son, which you expect, of course, from Spielberg. So many of his movies have these characters who are searching for father figures, but it just combines. And I said this during our top five Spielberg scenes, because I think the three challenges sequence, the penitent man shall pass, was my number two. That's how much I love that scene and love this film overall. There's that great intercutting between Connery and Harrison Ford as he's on this mission, them almost talking to each other. We see them having this dialogue with each other.
Penitent man will pass. Penitent man.
Who are the penitent men?
They're just some of those great moments in the film where they discover things about each other as father and son, the things as a father he's never said to him before. And then we get that emotional moment where Connery thinks Harrison Ford's gone over the cliff and he's dead. And there's genuine emotion there in that loss. And the scene that happens at the end of the Penitent Man Shall Pass sequence where Harrison Ford, Indy, is reaching for that grail and Connery tells him, just let it go. Let it go. It's this whole notion of obsession. They're both obsessive characters to a fault, right? Their relationship has been strained because of Connery's devotion to finding this object. And in that moment, it comes to choosing between that object or his son. And he very clearly says, son, let it go. It's such a great cathartic moment. You get that throughout this film, in addition to all the great action and adventure.
Is it Spielberg's richest father-son relationship? I mean, that's one thing that's notable about his films, right? That the father figure can be, if not actually absent, mm-hmm. a little bit distant from the children. And here, it's like the exact opposite. And I think it really adds to the film. You're right. The chemistry there is fantastic. I think The Last Crusade is also a good example of, to use a very unartistic phrase, but franchise extension done well. Watching it again, you can see how much J.J. Abrams, he's learned a lot from Spielberg, but he's also learned how to revisit properties and re-energize them while still staying true to what they were. Because after Temple of Doom, I mean, that thing was off the rails, right? Yeah. Pretty much. I know it has its defenders, but the franchise was off the rails. And so what Spielberg did, especially that opening scene with River Phoenix as a young Indiana Jones, mm-hmm. is reestablish everything that was good about the original and then took it a little bit further. And I think Abrams has been doing similar things with the Star Trek films and hopefully with Star Wars. All right, we'll finish our lists of the top five movies of 1989 when we come back. I predict My Heart Will Go On for James Cameron, while Adam's going to find another way to get some more Shakespeare into the show. Stay with us. Well, she's kind of like an artist, sitting on the floor. Never finishes, she abandons, never shows a soul. And she's kind of like a movie everyone rushes to see, and no one understands it, sitting in their seats. She opens her mouth to speak and what comes out to mystery. Thought about, not understood, she's a
Hi, this is John C. Reilly, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Okay, these are so your eyes can focus in the breathing fluid. How's that feel? There it is. If you can't see, you can't disarm the bomb, right? Okay, with this much weight, you're gonna fall like a brick. We still got about an hour, so we should get there in plenty of time. When you get down there, all you gotta do is cut one wire, drop the weights, and come on home.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. That's Ed Harris, getting his marching orders in 1989's The Abyss. Director James Cameron, of course. Back in May, Josh, you may recall, we did our top five films of 1991, another mm-hmm. year-by-year countdown. I'm sure it tied in with some Sacred Cow review. Your number three slot went to Cameron's Terminator 2, Judgment Day. Here we are, a couple months later. We're counting down our top five films of 1989, and holy James Cameron loved Batman.
Who knew, right?
Yeah.
Well, these have always been among my two favorite Cameron films. And when I revisit them, I think obviously T2 stands up, but The Abyss really does too. I mean, it's even despite the problematic ending, I'll get that out of the way first. And I'm talking about both the theatrical ending and the director's cut ending. I don't know if either of those really solve many of the problems that are going on there, but what happens before is so thrilling emotionally and viscerally that I'm not really taken out of the film by that ending. The main plot involves an oil rig crew who's commandeered by a Navy SEAL team to help recover this sunken submarine. Ed Harris is the oil crew foreman, and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio is his estranged wife. She also designed this advanced underwater oil drilling station where much of the movie takes place. I noticed that a friend of the show, Peter Labuza, recently rewatched The Abyss on Letterboxd. I saw his notes there, and he said the film's strength comes in the details of slowness. No one can move quickly in water, so everything sort of glides awkwardly, and each crash and bump is felt. It's also a film deeply invested in creating a legible architecture, especially for a space surrounded in almost pitch black. Cameron's opening sequences in the cavernous oil rig slowly connect the dots of A to B and use the numerous windows to point out the relationship of the outside area to each inside. That's very true. I mean, this is marvelous use of space here to set up the action. But there's one reason this is really on my list,
okay.
And it doesn't have much to do with that. It's that this has the best rising water suspense sequence of all time.
But isn't that the end of the film?
It's not the end of the film. No, the end, it gets very close encounters, if you remember.
I remember
with the rising. And the end of the film involves the scene we just played of Harris going deeper down to explore. But this sequence of Harris and Mastro Antonio trapped in the submarine where the water is rising, it might even be in the middle of the film. And man, is it, you know, we've seen these sequences over and over, time and time again, but how many times have we seen them between two characters who have such a richly drawn relationship and a conflicted one at the same time? The key is when they're trapped in the submersible and they find out they've only got the one oxygen suit.
Okay. We got to get you out of here.
How?
I don't know how.
We've only got one suit.
I know, but we've got to come
up with
something.
Oh, my God, I'm breathing.
Listen, you're smart. Think of something. Can't you think of something? Think of something.
Okay, why don't you swim back to the rig and bring back another suit?
It only took me that 7-8 minutes to swim, get the gear, come back. I wouldn't make it. Look at this. By the time I got back, you'd be...
It isn't until they make that realization that simultaneously you recognize they are also realizing they're still in love.
Yeah.
And the way that comes together, it's just perfect. It's an intensely romantic scene. So never mind Titanic, The Abyss, that's James Cameron's love story. And for that, it's my number three film of 89.
Well, I do like The Abyss quite a bit. I remember seeing it not in theaters, but on HBO and stuff the ensuing year. And I know that there always has been some discussion, I don't know if controversy is the right word or not, about the ending of the film. All I know is the version I saw on HBO, I liked a lot. So I don't know what the problem with the ending is.
It's not, I think it's just that it doesn't live up to, okay, here's what it is for me. It gets bigger than the people. And somehow something like Close Encounters, I think, which has a similar huge scale ending, it's connected to Dreyfus's Rhaenyra as well. And here, the spectacular is a little further removed from Harris and Mastrantonio, who are the heart of the film.
Well, a movie I need to revisit. My number three follows nicely on the heels of my number four pick, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, as we were talking about father and son relationships. Certainly this film is about that. And as a born and bred Iowan, I think I'm obligated to pick it if I'm looking back at the films of 1989. It is Field of Dreams. And I do want to note for the record that my days of romanticizing the sport of baseball are long gone. Maybe, in fact, the last time I romanticized the sport of baseball was when I saw Field of Dreams in 1989. It's been a long time since I really cared about the sport. But this movie grabs me every single time it's on. And of course, it is on TBS or TNT or something once or twice a year. And there's some Saturday or Sunday where I'm flipping channels trying to be distracted from whatever it is I should be doing. And I do get caught up in it. Of course, as an American male who grew up playing catch with his dad and who did feel often at odds with his dad, yes, it gets a little dusty at the end of the film when Costner asks his father if he wants to have a catch. But Josh, it's not that scene so much, and it's not really even those emotional moments. There are many other scenes that just grab me every time. It is these smaller moments. For example, when James Earl Jones says, "Moonlight Graham," after they've gone to the game and he's just dropped him off at his place and he's going to stay in Boston and Costner's going to go off to Minnesota chasing what he saw on the scoreboard. And Costner just explodes. You saw it. That validation that he's not crazy, that someone else saw what he saw. And you get that excitement with Costner contrasted with James Earl Jones' skepticism. When Timothy Busfield, near the end of the film, is ranting about selling the farm and Costner says, "Hey, this is Terrence Mann," and they do this little introduction, and he says, "Yeah, right, and I'm the Easter Bunny." The laugh that James Earl Jones gives us is just priceless. Like, he's just having a ball in this moment and recognizing what that character must think when he hears that this famous writer is sitting there. That James Earl Jones performance, every time I think about it, I go online and have to verify that he didn't get an Oscar nomination. I'm shocked he did not get an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor, because he is just so brilliant in the movie. But the real scene, Josh, that I literally still get tingles from every time I see it, is the scene where they've just left Burt Lancaster and Moonlight Graham, gone back into the past somehow, this supernatural evening that Costner has when he goes out and ends up back in 1972. They're heading back to Iowa. James Earl Jones has decided to come with them. They feel like they've missed something. They don't really understand why they were supposed to go there. And they see a hitchhiker, a young man hitchhiking. And Costner says, "I'm going to stop and pick him up. I need all the good karma I can."
"Thanks. You're the first car by.
How far are you going?"
"How far are you going?"
"Iowa."
"Well, if it's okay with you, I think I'll just ride along a while. I play baseball."
"Hop in."
"All right." "Looking for a place to play. I heard that all through the Midwest, they have towns with teams. And in some places, well, they'll even find you a day job so you can play ball nights and weekends."
"Well, this is your lucky day, kid. We're going someplace kind of like that."
"All right."
"I'm Ray Kinsella. This is Terrence Mann."
"Hi. I'm Archie Graham."
Costner and Jones, they just pause for a second, stunned. It's this moment where the stars align, the supernatural quest has all come together, and you mix that with Frank Whaley's youthful optimism, that sense of hope in his voice. You've got three generations of American men there in that car, all with distinctly different viewpoints on America and Americans. And there's just something so much more profound, I think, going on in Field of Dreams, other than being just a great sports movie. It also, Josh, features some of the best uses of that classic kind of John Wayne, John Ford stagecoach tracking in on a character dramatically for emphasis. You get a lot of those shots. The director really uses them well, where you see a character like Burt Lancaster or James Earl Jones going out into the cornfield and the camera just tracks slightly for effect. Very good stuff.
At the risk of having my U.S. citizenship revoked, can I confess that I've not seen Field of Dreams?
What? That's not even possible.
It's true.
That's not even possible.
It is true. Yes. See, I think a lot of these blind spots are if you grew up in a house without cable, actually, where these things aren't playing on a loop. That could be it. It could also be that I despised Little League. I mean, do you think as someone who did not ever have a romantic attachment to baseball, the movie would still work?
Without a doubt.
All right.
For all the reasons I just said.
I'll give it a try.
It's ultimately a father and son story.
It's not something I've actively resisted. It's just,
right.
Even when I look at the list of films from 89 I haven't seen, you know, I put others ahead of it to catch up.
Much more than about baseball. It's really about, it's really about family, and it really is about what identifies us as Americans. There's a great scene that when you think back on it, you're like, that's in Field of Dreams, where Costner and his wife, Amy Madigan, go to this town hall type meeting at their school where some of the people in the town want to ban certain books from being read, and she has to stand up for it. And it really does stand out, but it fits perfectly with all the other themes of the film.
All right, I'll give it a try. My number two, it's one you predicted. You were right, The Little Mermaid.
I knew it would be on your list.
Well, of course, it's great.
And it's animated, and well, it's Disney.
Think about it, though. It's such a key Disney film because the mini renaissance, it began here and carried a couple films into the 1990s, but this was the start of it, the adaptation of the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale. It's also a return to Disney's princess roots. It had strayed away from that a little bit in the films prior to this. And here you've got the mermaid Ariel, who must overcome this conniving witch figure to gain her freedom and independence. Now, the witch, Ursula, voiced by Pat Carroll, envisioned as this husky nightclub chanteuse with tentacles, got a lot of time on the show Tasha Robinson of The Dissolve and I did, tied to Maleficent. We listed our top five Disney villains. Tasha had Ursula as number one. I think she was my number two or three. The Little Mermaid, though, was also a return to form for Disney in the sense of it being a musical, which they had also gotten a little bit away from. And so here you have this journey of Ariel that's outlined as much through song as it is through action. And composer was Alan Menken, lyricist Howard Ashman. They really indulged in a wide array of styles here with Under the Sea, Part of This World, and Kiss the Girl. You've got some that are bouncy, some are operatic. And everyone, though, does work for the story that's being told. The animation itself, I think, was a little bit of a step forward, too, for Disney at the time. They retained this penchant for anthropomorphized figures so that animals move and behave like humans. But it's really at the service of some rich characterization here. So you have Sebastian the crab or Flounder, Ariel's companion, and of course Ursula too. And the underwater imagery, it's quite astonishing. I mean, it has this delicate watery shimmer before we got used to it maybe through CGI. It's here in traditional animation. So that the droplets, they do look like they're going to fall right off the screen. So Little Mermaid, 1989, it was the first sign that things were getting back on track in a really good way for Disney.
I like The Little Mermaid a lot, and I do want to note for the record, no one can steal this. Husky Nightclub Chanteuse is the name of my next band. So
you like that one?
As long as we have that down. But
I'm going to start selling these to you.
You should.
The one you choose for your band is going to be big bucks.
But in 89, I had a 9-year-old sister, a 5-year-old sister, and a new baby sister.
Oh, no. So talk about being on a loop.
The Little Mermaid literally was on a loop.
Yeah.
All day long, home with them, we watched The Little Mermaid. And you know what? It never really got old. I always liked it.
Okay, good.
So
good.
It's a good
pick. I was going to say you might have some Clockwork Orange associations with The Little Mermaid then.
No, nowhere near my top 10 for the year, but a good film. Maybe in the top 15,
there
Josh.
There you go.
Well, my number two, gosh, I don't know if I'm ready for this. Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention, a kingdom for a stage, princes to act and monarchs to behold the swelling scene. Then should the warlike Harry, like himself, assume the port of Mars, and at his heels, leashed in like hounds, should famine, sword, and fire crouch for employment. I could go on.
Can I use
I could go on
all
and on.
Of that for my band name?
Ah, man, I didn't even get to the vasty fields of France, or may we cram within this wooden O the very casks that did affright the air at Agincourt.
Now you're getting a little long for the drum kit.
I am. That is, of course, from the opening to Henry V, Derek Jacobi, the chorus in Kenneth Branagh's rendition of the William Shakespeare play, Henry V. And this goes back to our recent discussion of My Own Private Idaho, of course, how much I love this whole storyline and these characters that are part of this world, Henry IV parts 1 and 2, and Henry V. But one of the many aspects of Branagh's Henry V I love, and I know this will shock you, because I never really talk about how much I love meta moments or movies that call attention to the filmmaking. But I love the meta nature of this, where at the beginning of the play, Branagh doesn't just choose to forego the chorus, which he doesn't need and which doesn't even make any sense because it ends with the character saying, you know, take in our play and try to use your imagination. But he uses it instead. He beseeches the audience to recognize the limitations of these sets and these locations and how hard it's going to be to try to bring such an epic tale to life on the screen. It sets the tone for the whole film right from that very beginning. And I could go through a litany of amazing speeches and scenes. Once more onto the breach, St. Crispin's Day. Henry, when he goes incognito among his men to kind of suss out how they're feeling the night before the big battle. But one that has always stood out to me as well is his proposal to Catherine, the chemistry between Branagh and Emma Thompson, who were husband and wife at the time, and the humor of it as he has to use his broken French to try to get her to understand why they should be married.
I will tell thee in French.
Oh.
Which I am sure will hang about my tongue like a new married wife about her husband's neck, hardly to be shook off. Je compte sur la position de France et quand vous avez la position de moi, let me see. Donc, votre et France. Vous êtes mien. It is as easy for me, Kate, to conquer the kingdom as to speak so much more French. I will never move thee in French unless it be to laugh at me.
He really, Branagh, that is, humanizes this Henry V character in a way that, like, if you go back and watch the 45 Laurence Olivier version, he just tries to make him this majestic, regal figure that was there almost as propaganda to energize the British people. It might have been 45 or earlier in the war, but there's definitely something very jingoistic about Olivier's Henry V. And you don't get that nearly as much in Branagh's version, where we even see him flash back to Henry IV and show this character having no mercy on his former pub mates, the Falstaff type characters. And it just makes him a much more difficult character to like, even though it's very clear that he's supposed to be our hero. It's just one of those movies that is so formative for me. I didn't see it in 1989. I saw it a few years later when I was a senior in high school, when I started studying in this one class, plays like Henry V and poetry and getting into some great literature. And it just had a huge influence on why I wanted to read books and poetry and see plays and movies and analyze and argue about them, really getting into that Henry V character and trying to figure out what made him tick and whether or not he was someone likable or not, or how Shakespeare was depicting him, how we were supposed to interpret him. That really did launch me on what we're sitting here doing right now.
There were two films from 89 I knew were going to be on your list. Henry V was one, I'm pretty sure. I know your number one is them. My number one, however, is The Decalogue. And this is from Polish director Krzysztof Kieślowski. It's a 10-part series of short films. They're each set in the same Warsaw apartment complex, and each thematically ties to one of the Ten Commandments. This series, it made its debut on Polish television in 1989, but it took a few years for outside audiences to become aware of it. Eventually, though, as more and more people saw it and more critics were writing about it, it became recognized really as one of the major cinematic achievements of the past 20 or 30 years, even making an appearance on Roger Ebert's Sight and Sound list of the best films of all time. He put it on there when he did the list in 2002. There aren't always obvious correlations between the installment and a certain commandment. This is something Ebert noted as well. But that's sort of what I liked about this collection. Kieślowski's first concern is really the everyday moral dilemmas that people face. And then he allows room for the mosaic laws that might apply to kind of send echoes into the story. Ebert put it this way. At the end, you see that the commandments work not like science, but like art. They are instructions for how to paint a worthy portrait with our lives. I think the Decalogue is a little bit like Ida in this way, the Polish film about a young nun in training that we both named as one of the best of the year so far. It has both the Decalogue and Ida, they have this ability to make transcendent concerns deeply personal and root them in individual stories. So the Decalogue, it's my number one. It was long unavailable, but you can now get DVD sets, including one from Chicago's Facets.
The Decalogue. So I'm going to put you on the spot. Have you seen all 10 installments?
I have seen all 10, but I've really only written and dug into the first one. Mm-hmm. I would love to do all of them, a deep look at all of them, because they really do deserve it.
Yeah, back a few years ago here on the show, Maddie and I did a Kieślowski marathon, and we watched a short film about love and a short film about killing. For some reason, it sticks in my mind, maybe number 2 and number 7 in the series. I could be completely wrong, but we saw those two and reviewed them both very favorably, had good discussions about them. But those are the only two I've seen. Okay. So for me, the Decalogue can't really count. You're right. You know what's coming surely here with my number one, Josh. It is Woody Allen's Crimes and Misdemeanors, my favorite film of 1989. And I've always said this about this film. I love it because for me, it's the perfect Woody Allen combination of comedy and drama. There are hilarious moments in this film, all usually involving Woody's character and Mia Farrow's character and Alan Alda, who Woody has been hired to make a documentary about. He's this very famous television producer, and Woody's character kind of despises everything he stands for. And you get their great exchanges and all the stuff about tragedy plus time. And if it bends, it's funny. If it breaks, it isn't funny. And you get quips from Woody, like, the last time I was inside a woman was when I visited the Statue of Liberty. So there are those moments of comedy, but then mixed with what you get from the main storyline of Martin Landau's Judah, who's an ophthalmologist who's having an affair with Angelica Houston. She wants to be with him and threatens to take down his marriage if they can't be together. And like Henry V, I have to say, maybe sadly, I was reflecting on this, Josh, as I was thinking about my number one pick. This is another formative movie for me in the sense that it affected my worldview in general. It's the film that made me realize that art often shows us idealized versions of ourselves. People who do really bad things in movies or books, other types of art, are often so racked with guilt that they ultimately confess, or they're punished for their crimes eventually, or at the last minute, goodness prevails, morality prevails, and they don't do the horrible deed they were considering. Crimes has the conviction to show us that that isn't necessarily how the world works. In fact, that isn't how it works most often. And you get that great line at the end of the film from Martin Landau's character where he says, "In reality, we rationalize, we deny, or we couldn't go on living." It's cynical, absolutely. It's harsh. But it's 100% accurate, and I think it's as true as any sentiment cinema's ever given us. I think it's that reflective of the human experience. And I also love about Crimes and Misdemeanors that it's a perfect 1989 movie for this list. You talk about movies that define a decade or are kind of an epitaph for a decade. This decade defined by excess and greed and the rich, people like Judah prospering, while the poor, people like Dolores, who's a flight attendant who is kind of wowed by his sophistication and his wealth, she's taken advantage of. She's exploited. The rich are getting richer at the expense of people like her, and she is ultimately completely expendable. And there's kind of a throwaway moment, actually, in one of their exchanges that I love. It's always been one of the keys to the movie for me, where she brings up the fact that at one point he borrowed money from the hospital or something. I don't remember the exact specifics, but she brings up to use against him that she's aware that he did some funneling of funds. And I think he even explains, well, I gave it all back, I returned it, and with interest and all this stuff. But that's what he does. Again, he rationalizes. He found a way to justify something that was maybe not morally wrong, but certainly ethically wrong, and he got away with it because people like Judah think they can and ultimately can get away with it. The only issue I've ever had with Crimes and Misdemeanors actually is in Angelica Houston's performance. It's a little bit unhinged to the point where, yes, I understand that she's supposed to be very upset and very forceful in trying to get what she wants, but she actually makes her so hysterical at times that you're kind of rooting for Judah to get rid of her, just to get her out of the picture because she's annoying. And I'd like to empathize with that character a little bit more. But for me, it's up there in my favorite Woody Allen films of all time. It's up there in my favorite films of all time. And I know we split on this movie.
Yeah, you know, we've largely been able to talk around our general Woody Allen split since I've been on the show. There haven't been many instances, and we found a really strong common ground in Manhattan, which I absolutely loved when I watched for the first time recently. But this is one that just epitomizes for me what gets me stuck on a lot of Woody Allen. And it's, you know, there's something we could argue in circles around, and it doesn't matter. I don't find him generally as funny. So when you talk about the humor being a key to this, it's one of the reasons why I think Match Point is the superior version of this, is because there's no Woody Allen on screen. But another reason is that this has the desperate wanting to be taken seriously that just exudes from some of Allen's pictures, and it comes through when you get the literalness of the themes. Okay,
without a doubt.
So the symbolism and the
eyes
the
and God is watching,
the philosophical pontificating, all of that stuff. I just find for me works better when it's going on under the surface, as he does in Match Point. So I know I'm alone on that one, but this is one of those I just can't get on board with.
No, after doing the show with you for a few years now, could have predicted that response, frankly, just because there is a certain literalness and heavy-handedness to the symbolism that I can see bugging you. For me, though, it's not a problem because it's precisely the type of symbolism that the filmmaker gets away with because he introduces it right from the beginning of the film. He says right at the very beginning, he gives us this character who expresses to the crowd that maybe why I went into ophthalmology is because I was haunted by this notion that the eyes of God are always watching us. So for me, all the other symbolism and mentions of that we get throughout the film are just fulfilling the promise of
callbacks,
the opening scene of the film.
And
it all works for me. I don't mind the literalness of it there. The other thing that we could disagree about, but I think in those moments where characters express those sentiments that seem to be them just underlining the themes of the film or the big philosophical questions, I believe in every moment that those characters are saying it. It doesn't feel like many other movies do, like the filmmaker is just putting those words in the characters' mouths. I believe that Judah would say exactly that in that moment.
Except that Judah is such a flip side of Allen.
So, I don't think so.
So it's, even in his mannerisms, I feel like he's doing the serious Allen. Allen's getting to the shticky Allen, and they're both talking like Allen thematically. So.
Yeah, I don't feel that about his performance, actually. I see it as much more restrained than that. So we split on that film, but Crimes and Misdemeanors is my number one, and those are our top five films of 1989. Just for kicks, Josh, did you contemplate what would have been your top five of 89 when you were in 1989?
I didn't do that.
A young
but
teen?
I did. I don't think it would have been, you know, I hadn't seen the Kieślowski, so Decalogue I had no awareness of. Little Mermaid probably would have been on there. I know The Abyss and Batman would have been. Let's see. And so The Killer saw recently.
Yeah.
So that would not have been. I did do my top 10 of 89, and it's actually filled out. So these would be the honorable mentions with a couple of your films. So I had on there Say Anything, And also Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and then Sex, Lies, and Videotape I would put on there as well. Dead Calm is the Australian film with Nicole Kidman that was on my top five movie boats list.
Yeah, I don't
recently.
See your attraction to that movie at all.
You've seen it?
I have.
Really?
Yeah, but just
what holds you
late
back
at night
from
when it was on TV when I was much younger.
Didn't
no,
grab you.
I haven't really considered it, to be totally honest with you, but
yeah, it's worth
it didn't
revisit.
Jump out to me
it's
at all.
It's worth a revisit, especially for Kidman's performance and understanding what's so good about her that maybe has gotten lost. And then the other to round out my top 10 would have been Kiki's Delivery Service. Good Miyazaki, probably not one of my favorite Miyazakis.
Okay. Well, the 14-year-old me, I would have had these movies in my top five just like now. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Say Anything, and Field of Dreams. Field of Dreams would have been my number one in 1989. My number two in 1989 would have been Dead Poets Society.
Yes, that needs a revisit.
And Major League definitely would have made the top five. So with those picks in there as honorable mentions, other ones you talked about, Batman did make your top five, of course. Born on the 4th of July, the Oliver Stone movie.
Hmm.
I really like that movie. And if you've never read or heard any of the commentary from Matt Zoller-Seitz, a great critic, about that film, that's his film. That film is just one for him. You talk about formative movies that just open your eyes to things. That's the movie for him, and he speaks really eloquently about the movie. I appreciated it even before I heard him talk about it, but after that, appreciated it even more. Drugstore Cowboy recently made my top five Pacific Northwest movies. The Killer also in my honorable mentions, and Roger and Me, the documentary
yep.
from
I thought that
Michael
might make
Moore.
It on your list. Good
so,
film.
Well, we talked a little bit at the beginning of the segment about the fact that we do these year-by-year countdowns, and sometimes the Sacred Cow influences that. We're actually making a little bit of a change here, and we're thinking about having the year-by-year countdown influence the Sacred Cow.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than just starting from every movie ever made, what's a good Sacred Cow pick? Let's go and look at the year we may be focusing on, and if I'm correct, I do think it's 1992 that's the next year up.
That sounds right.
We jumped ahead to 91, but it's time for 1992. Why don't we pick a Sacred Cow review from the list of 1992 movies that stand out. We've had this discussion. We've talked to our producer, Sam, and right now we're going to put this poll question at the website. You, the listener, are going to get to decide. It's listener's choice which movie is our next Sacred Cow.
They make the final decision?
I think so. Unless
wow.
we disagree with
I didn't
with
know
them.
You were going to get that crazy.
If we disagree,
yes.
then...
Keep in mind as you hear this that Adam will always have the right to override your decision.
I will go with whatever they
you
say.
Think this is a democracy?
You're the one who seems a little nervous, but the two options right
it's
now...
It's going to be Reservoir Dogs.
I know, it is. So
there's
why
nothing
are we
to worry
talking about it? Reservoir Dogs, Quentin Tarantino's movie, that I know many of you right now are shaking your head going, what? Adam talking more about Reservoir Dogs like we need that? But you know what? Yes, it's come up in top fives and different things. Haven't seen Reservoir Dogs since 1992.
Oh, wow.
I haven't. No, I've seen parts of it here and there.
It's been a while for me.
I would really like to revisit it. And the other one would be The Unforgiven.
That would
the
be
the best
good.
Picture winner of that year,
that
if I'm
would
not
be
mistaken.
Good.
So,
you know, I'd love to do both, but I would probably lean that way because that's the one I have not seen since 92.
And I'm just the opposite.
Yeah.
I actually just saw The Unforgiven for the first time 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay.
I didn't see it when
either
it came
one
out.
Will be good.
So, that's why we're going to follow whatever the listeners decide, Josh. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. We may throw in one of our Pantheon movies into the mix as well, Glengarry Glen Ross, a 1992 film. So find the choices there. Vote in the poll. Tell us what Sacred Cow we should review next. And also tell Josh why he's wrong about Crimes and Misdemeanors, my favorite film of 1989.
You don't need
you
to call
also,
in support for that. I
no,
mean, everyone loves Crimes and
you
Misdemeanors.
You know what? Send in your picks, any other comments about the show. It doesn't have to be about Crimes and Misdemeanors. Email feedback at filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. Or you can find us on Twitter. Adam tweets at filmspotting. I'm at Larson on Film. You can also follow us on Facebook, of course, facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, one of the big releases that Josh somehow is interested in seeing, despite seeing a preview or two, Tammy, the new Melissa McCarthy film
going
with Susan
back to
Sarandon.
The democracy thing.
Yeah.
I believe the word you threw out was boycott.
I'm boycotting it.
when,
I've seen
when
the trailer.
I suggested we, so you're breaking your trailer rule.
Sometimes.
And?
Sometimes it comes on in front of you. What am I supposed to do? Avert my eyes?
And allowing a trailer to determine that you're going to boycott a film. All right, fine.
I'm a hypocrite. What can I say? Out
I'll
in limited release here in Chicago at the Gene Siskel Film Center, Gore Vidal, The United States of Amnesia. That's a documentary about the late writer and intellectual I do want to see. At the Music Box, A Hard Day's Night. Here's another potential Sacred Cow option down the road, the 50th anniversary re-release of that Beatles movie, Snowpiercer, is opening. Bong Joon-ho directing, of course, Tilda Swinton. Surviving members of the human race confined to a train that travels the globe where a class system develops. Is that an accurate description? You've seen the movie.
It is as crazy as it sounds and as good as it sounds. Make your way to the music box. Yeah, this is worth seeing.
You need to see it.
You need to see it.
It didn't make your top 10.
It didn't make my top 10, but it's a ton of fun. I think a lot of people will have it on their top 10. So, yeah, catch Snowpiercer.
Okay. Also opening, Begin Again, director John Carney, he of once fame. This movie stars Mark Ruffalo and Keira Knightley.
Can I boycott that one based on the trailer?
How dare you?
But I saw the trailer. It's terrible.
It isn't great, but the director made Once, and that's all you need to know. Also out, Life Itself, the Roger Ebert documentary directed by Steve James. This is a movie that we reviewed many months ago back on the show, but it is finally opening here in Chicago. Needless to say, we do heartily recommend seeing Life Itself. Next week on the show, we're going to look ahead a little bit to a movie that's opening that weekend, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And our top five at this point, we don't really know. Sam actually notes here that we got an email recently from a listener who said, you know, Obvious Child came out, Jenny Slate in that movie. I've seen it and do recommend seeing that as well. And Night Moves, we talked about recently, both movies that also have song titles, though Bob Seger is nowhere to be found in the Kelly Reichardt film. Paul Simon, very present in Obvious Child, and that's great because I love that tune.
Where are you going here? Is there a song, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, anywhere?
No. See, there's no connection whatsoever, but we're so desperate at this point that we might have to go with listener Ross Jones's idea to do top five movies with songs as titles.
Okay. I'm still thinking animal movies, movies about animals.
But we talked about this, Josh. We've already done recently top five pets. Movie Pets.
But Pets, there's a lot more animal movies than that.
You want to get into the nuances of pets and animals. Sounds riveting.
And whether apes are monkeys and all that. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and to the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. Also, special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our music this week comes from The Replacements and their 1989 album, Don't Tell a Soul. More information is at thereplacementsofficial.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.